Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto, which, if you're hearing this podcast for the first time, is a chapter of our national organization, the National Speleological Society, or NSS. If you're here because you're curious about cave exploration or taking trips through wild caves, that is, caves that are not developed for tourism with things like lights and walkways, let me be the first to welcome you to something that may very well change your life. It certainly changed mine, and I don't even do it that much. I just have a background in radio and audio editing, and I've been involved in grotto leadership, but I just love to go caving. Most of the people that I feature on this podcast, though, are actual exploration cavers, people who literally go where no one has gone before. They survey and map what we call virgin passage, and this month's guest is someone who has miles of virgin passage under his belt. More on him in a bit. But again, if you're thinking about it, you should know that you really should find cavers to take you on your first trip. Get in touch with your local grotto and make friends. Caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, so get in touch with the right people and do it the right way. I should apologize right off the bat if you're someone who likes to listen to this podcast the day that it comes out. I always put them out on the first of every month. It's late at night on the Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend, and it was a busy one and a rough one, too. My family and I all have colds. I'm sounding a little better today, if you can believe it, but my two-year-old and my four-month-old have been sick, and so our schedules have been real fun. So I didn't get to finalize it earlier today like I'd hoped I would. Still managed to get it out by midnight, but just barely. Thanks for your patience. Real quick, and this concerns anyone who wants to support cave conservation, a supporter of the podcast has asked that I feature a different karst conservancy every month. And this month, I've chosen the West Virginia Cave Conservancy. Cavers know there's lots of cave in West Virginia, and it's worth protecting. The West Virginia Cave Conservancy owns lots of preserves and manages a few more. They own Donaldson Cave, which is a bat hibernaculum. Island Ford Cave, which saw a lot of negative traffic over the years, and so there was a lot of graffiti that's been cleaned up there by the Conservancy. Also, entrances to Benedict Cave and McClung Cave, which are 15-plus-mile-long systems, pretty significant, but they have potential development over them, so they need protection. And I'm really thankful that, and we should all be thankful, that the West Virginia Cave Conservancy owns those and many other preserves. If you want to help them out and stay in touch, consider joining or maybe just make a donation. Last I checked, if you join at just the $250 level, you're automatically a member for life. Again, I'm not absolutely positive that that's still the policy, but according to the information that I have, that's still in effect. So if you're feeling generous and you want to help out a great organization, you can visit the West Virginia Cave Conservancy online at wvcc.net, and I'll put a link in the description. There you can join or simply just make a donation. If everyone who listens to this podcast just gave a dollar, they'd have a few thousand extra dollars this month alone. Tis the season. Giving Tuesday is this coming week. It's easy. Do it right now. They've got the PayPal button right there. Go to wvcc.net. Quick calendar update. I heard from Dustin with the Greater Cincinnati Grotto, which would be my grotto if I still live back where I grew up in southeastern Indiana. They put on Karstorama every year at the Great Saltpeter Preserve in Kentucky. I love that place. Anyway, save the date. They're going to do KOR the weekend of June 19th, 2020. If I can make it, I'm going to try to go. And I hope to see you there, too. Always a great party, or so I've heard. I've never been, but maybe this year I'll get to go. Again, June 19th, mega note, Karstorama at Kentucky's Great Saltpeter Preserve. Courtesy of the Greater Cincinnati Grotto. Okay, Adam Weaver. As you'll hear, this guy gets after it. He's a real exploration caver who's done so much. Jewel Cave, first and foremost, but also Wind Cave, Lechuguilla, Fort Stanton Cave. Wow, you're in for a real treat. So I won't waste any more of your time. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Adam Weaver. Do you have like an official title within the NSS? You have a caves.org email address.
Well, yeah. So I'm on the board of governors currently. I was just elected in the last election. So I've been to one and a half meetings.
I think I voted for you.
Oh, well, thank you.
You were among the cliques. We're already off to a good start. Why did you want to join the board of governors?
It's kind of a funny story. So here in the Black Hills, we're making a new cave conservancy, hopefully, and we're working on acquiring 9 caves. And I was trying to work with the NSS to do that, and I couldn't find a good avenue to do that and a good contact. And I was one of the members of our grotto is on the bog also, you know. So she was like, "Why don't you run for the bog?" And I was like, I thought, Savannah, why would I want to do that? And she was like, "You should do it because you're really passionate about fixing this problem." And I did, and I won. So, but I mean, really, the biggest thing for me with the NSS is I think that the organization is so large that the more we can connect the internal groups together, the better off we'll all be because we all have different strengths. So if we can find a way to get more interconnected, that's really my goal, you know.
Do you think that that's somewhere where the national organization maybe not necessarily falls short, but could use a little work just with more people that want to bring all the nationwide groups together?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that like I said, it's such a large organization that it's really easy for a couple of things to happen. You know, first of all, people get involved. Like all of our officers are doing it. They do a great job and they're all working really hard for the organization, but there's only so much they can do. They're volunteers and they're working. So I think the more people that we can find that start trying to make a difference, it'll make it the organization better. And, you know, right now there's not a whole lot of support, direct support for grottos. You know, the grottos are kind of where our organization thrives. You know, when you want to start caving and you find a group, you find the grotto, you don't find the big NSS. So the more we can help those groups be stronger, the bigger group will be, you know. And and that's one of my goals. And I have some things in the works to try to make that happen as much as I can.
Well, what about if you could envision like a national association of NSS members that would be devoted to one particular strength? Where do you think there's the most need? Like, what would that group be in support of or talk about as sort of a main objective? Do you think that there's a need for that within the NSS, that there's a need to focus on one particular thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone within the NSS and everyone who's working to make it a better thing. You know, one thing that I guess is important to bring up here is that if you look at the organization, we're getting a lot of new people. I mean, there's obviously a lot of long-term members, but we're getting a lot of new members now. And there's a lot of new ideas coming in. And I think that's really good for the organization. I think that everyone has a different idea about what we should be doing. But to me, at the basis of what the NSS is, it's that all of us had a time when it was our first cave trip, and we left there and we were very excited and we thought, this is something I want to do again immediately, you know? And I think the NSS and every grotto, that's why we're here. We're here to give someone that kind of trip where they, you know, changes their life. They become a caver almost instantly, you know, when they find that love. And I think that there's a lot of different aspects that you have to make that happen. And I mean, obviously access is the most important because you can't have that first cave trip if you can't get into a cave.
It sounds to me like what is needed, and I think that a lot of people would agree with this, are cavers that are willing to take beginners and can craft good beginner trips, the kind of trip that would cement caving in people's minds as a thing that they want to do. Because that's what happened to me. That's what happened to me. Paul Uglum took me on my first trip. Paul Uglum's taken a lot of people on their first trips.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
just really
Absolutely.
Good at that. And every grotto, hopefully, has somebody that's like that, or a few people, ideally. And I think that if those people put their heads together on what makes a good first cave trip, what is a good way to hook people, then I think then we would have something. We would have not only new members, but members that stuck around.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm from the Paz Topa Grotto, and, you know, our membership, I think 2.5-3 years ago, we had 4 people in the rolls. And, you know, last week I guess saw that we're right at 100 members now. And you know, that's one of the things that we did. We said, well, by God, we're going to go caving, you know.
you figured it out, didn't you?
Yeah, we're like, so, I mean, this month there were 25 cave trips of all different skill levels. You know, I went caving and I led a team, and we were in Joel Cave for 18 hours on Sunday. That same day, there was a beginner trip that went into Onyx Cave for like 4 hours. And I think both teams had lots of fun.
Yeah.
You know, so
Like me, what I envision, and I would love to do this, what I envision is in, I don't know, 3-4 years or maybe a little longer when my kids are, you know, old enough to actually go. I mean, my hope is that they would like to go caving. I'm not counting on it. You're lucky in that your 6-year-old does. But I would love to be that person who goes, you know, maybe every other weekend and takes a big group of just recreational cavers from the grotto and keeps the grotto active. Like, then those people go to the meeting because they want to talk to the rest of the people about the trips that they did. Maybe they bring friends. That's just, as long as you're going caving, as long as your group is going caving, people are going to stay involved.
You know, and it's also, I think that one thing that, you know, as we started looking back, you know, our grotto, as it started to grow and we started doing more things, one thing that happened was there were members that had not been part of our grotto, for some of them for 30 years, that kind of popped back up out of the woodwork and started talking to us.
Because you started doing stuff.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so we now have 3 of the founding members of our grotto that founded it in the 60s back in our grotto again, which is pretty exciting. And they have all kinds of great stories. If you ever want to talk to somebody for 12 hours about caving, you should find a guy named Bruce Zur, and he'll talk to you about caving until you have to go to bed. I think he lives in Indiana, actually.
Oh, really? But, all right.
Yeah. But he was one of the founders of our grotto here, and he's a great guy. But so one of the things that I kind of figured out, too, along the way, you know, we looked at, is there ever history? Anytime there was a huge project going on, the grotto numbers ballooned up real big because there were lots of cave trips going, and there was lots happening, and people could get excited about something, you know. And I think, you know, like I said, access is important. Excitement is equally important. You have to be able to get in there, and you have to be able to build excitement about what you're doing, you know. One thing that I, you know, and we can kind of talk about my caving background, but one thing when I started caving here in the Black Hills, the only kind of caving that we had at the time, and most of the caving here still, is project caving. And until I went to my first convention, I didn't even know there was a different kind of caving. I just knew.
You were just exploring. Like, you're just like, okay, this is like, what you do.
Yeah. I was like, okay, we get trained up and then we go survey. And then I went to convention and all these people were like, no, we just go in the cave and look around. I'm like, oh, I didn't know that was an option.
Well, let's talk about your project caving. So if that was all you knew for a while, where did you start?
So for me, I have kind of a funny start because my very first cave trip was in Jewel Cave. You know, I'd been to tourist caves and lots of them like that. And then I was in the Air Force and I was going to Black Hills State, kind of just for fun, because when you're in the Air Force, you can take really any college class you went to for free. And they had an outdoors club. So I joined the outdoors club, and the very first trip the outdoors club went on was a caving trip in Jewel Cave on the Wild Cave Tour. And it was led by Dan Austin. You know, so I went there, I just thought it was fantastic. I was using this borrowed grotto gear and the lights were all janky and pointing the wrong way. So I didn't know any better to fix them. And I got done and I thought that was amazing. Like I was saying, it was like a light bulb went off. I was like, wow, I have to do this again. And Dan told me when the next grotto meeting was. So I showed up there and like I said, the lights were really bad. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go caving again. I got to get this fixed. And it was, you know, it was 10 years ago and I bought a Sten light. Like immediately. And so I go to the grotto meeting and so I'm like,
you came with the big guns right away.
Yeah. I came and I say, okay, I bought a Sten light and I'm going to go caving with anyone who'll take me. And at that point in time, that was, you know, that was the best light in the world.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, you bought a Sten light. I'm like, yeah, and I guess I'll go to any cave. It doesn't matter how big, I just want to go. And they're like, wow. Okay. So like after that, I got to go and everyone was taking me caving, all these different caves, all these cave trips. And you know, from there, I guess started going on harder and harder trips. And in Jewel Cave,
you can go on some pretty hard trips.
Yeah, it's a unique, Jewel is a very unique scenario where you can go basically on a trip as hard as you want it to be and go as far as you want to, you can go physically. I mean, the cave, there's almost no end to the cave. You know, we cave very fast in there. And it's not because we just like going fast. It's because we're going such a great distance that you can't go slower. You won't get any survey done. You know, so that's where I started. A funny part about that, too, is, you know, I went to Jewel Cave some, and then I went to Wind Cave for a while. And Wind Cave is a great cave. And it's, you know, today it's like 151 and a half miles long or something. But Jewel Cave and Wind Cave are very different kinds of caves to cave in. And I surveyed, I think, on 4 or 5 trips in Wind Cave, and this guy named Jason Walls, who's now working for Oregon Caves, he at the time he's like, yeah, people, they come here and they survey for a while, and if they go to Joel, they don't come back. And I said, that'll never happen. I'll never go to Joel and not come back. And so, but then I went to Joel for like 2 years and never went back to Wind Cave. I mean, you can go in Joel Cave. You know, I went last night. I was in Joel Cave for 4 hours last night. And in our team, we had two different survey teams. We were only in the cave for 4 hours, and we mapped, I think, almost 500 feet of new survey in that short amount of time, you know, including travel time to the lead. So there's just a lot to do there. It's a big cave. You can, like I said, the potential is amazing.
So in the Black Hills, have you explored a lot there? You talked about getting involved with a preserve. What are the caves there?
Yeah, so the preserve is kind of a, it's a different situation because, you know, the exploration of those caves, it was done quite a long time ago. And there's some cave, there's one cave in there in particular that's kind of a secret cave that is extremely beautiful. It's about 3,000 feet long, and about 50% of the cave is flowstone. And it has a very large pool in there that has a complete calcified bobcat skeleton in the bottom of it.
Wow. So,
yeah, and Rapid City, it's kind of moving towards that land. And so we're trying to make sure that nobody tries to build a house on top of it or something is part of that, because it's a very special cave. Another cave, other one of caves, it's called Brooks Cave. And Brooks Cave has been known about for a long time. And actually, when I was at convention this year, I bought a program from, it was the second or third NSS convention, which was here. And I didn't even know that. And they went to Brooks Cave in that convention, which was...
So people have been going there for a while. Yeah.
People have been going there for a long time. And it's a pretty it's a pretty large volume cave. It's not very long, but it does intersect the Madison Aquifer, which is pretty unique for a cave to go into the main aquifer in the Black Hills. The other two caves that do that in South Dakota are Wind Cave and Jewel Cave. So.
And it's not close either. It's not anywhere close to the...
You can get to the, I guess we'll call them lakes, in Brooks Cave in like 20 minutes if you want to. And in Jewel Cave, it takes 9 hours. So, one way.
So when you get down to the aquifer in Brooks Cave, what, it sumps or gets tight or what? There's access to it, but you can't really, there's no passage.
It sumps out. And then there's been various reports of people diving it in the past, but it was before my time. And the consensus is that it does not go through. There's many different stories. None of them end up with it going anywhere, you know?
Well, okay. So have you pretty much only done stuff in the Black Hills? Surely you ventured out from there.
Yeah. So like I said, you know, Winding Jewel were the big thing here in the Black Hills. And one of the great things about Jewel Cave, which makes it one of, in my opinion, which is obviously biased, one of the best places to start caving anywhere, is that Jewel Cave is very hard to go through, and people come from all over the country to experience that. You know, people think, all right, it can't be that hard, and they come here and they either love it or they don't come back. And so you meet people from all over the country. And so I've gotten the opportunity to cave in lots of different places. And I was lucky enough that when I started caving, there was a guy who just got back into caving after a long hiatus named Derek Bristol.
Yeah.
And so, everybody knows Derek, but yeah. So Derek and I were on a bunch of my first Jewel camp trip was Derek's second Jewel camp trip. And so we caved together for a long time. And I went to on four of Derek's Lecce Gia trips, the 8-day camp trips. So I spent quite a bit of time in Lecce. And my favorite cave by far that I've been to, though, is Fort Stanton Cave.
Oh, it's just, the Snowy River. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was lucky enough to go on five of those big trips, those big day trips, you know. And I was extra lucky because my very first Lecce Gia trip, you know, I don't know if you've been to Lecce.
No, I haven't. It's just a pie in the sky dream at this point.
So when you go to Lecce, you get this entrance briefing. You go to the office and the park staff, they give you a briefing about caving and special things for Lecce. And it takes like an hour or 2 hours or something, every trip though. And so my first time to Lecce, Stan Allison was still working at the park, and he was very tired. And he was telling us about it. He said, you know, I went to Fort Stanton Cave with the BLM to do this check trip to see if the formation is going to allow for travel across it. And we mapped 4,400 feet. And I thought, and I was sitting there the day before I went to Lecce Gia thinking, 4,400 feet in a day? You know, because I thought, oh my goodness. And so I went in Lechuguilla for 8 days, and I come out, and as soon as I came out, I was immediately on my computer trying to figure out how to email these people at Fort Stanton Cave, because I wanted in that cave.
Yeah.
And I was like, I have to find a way to go to Fort Stanton. And I was very lucky, because, you know, once people found out what was going on there, everyone wanted to go to Fort Stanton, but I got in before the masses kind of found out what that was, you know. And I have to tell you, especially in the Eastern United States, in Mammoth and in those big caves, there's a lot of borehole, but Fort Stanton has the unique thing that there's really not very many side passages. And it's just one borehole.
It's just the long snowy red. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, my first trip there, we went in, I think at that time it was like 5 or 6 miles one way. So we go in 5 or 6 miles, and you start, and you're in a passageway it's pretty significant in size, and you're just taking shots down it. And, you know, your average survey shot is like 150 feet, and you're surveying for 12 hours.
Good grief. Yeah. So it just, it's amazing to me, because it's like you hear about this cave and you hear about people going there and doing it. I mean, you only get to go there if you're among the best, but it's so easy once you get to where you're surveying, where you're starting. I mean, it's not easy getting there, because it's a long trip, but you know, you could just go. Well, what's the current status? I've heard that the current status is, you know, it's a little iffy.
Yeah, the current status is that I think at this very moment it's flooded, you know. So I mean, everybody knows the cave is very large, long passages, and it's mostly walking. But there is a section that is a crawlway, and it's, in my opinion, the worst crawlway in the world, even as a person who caves in Julian Wynn Cave.
Why is that?
Well, so it's very long, and I don't know the exact length. I would be certainly wrong if I tried to guess it, but it's over 1,000 feet long, I think. And the floor is extremely abrasive, so if you drag your arm or your pack across it, it's going to rub a hole in it pretty quick. Mm. And the ceiling, and it's white, and the ceiling is manganese. So you can't touch the ceiling, but you can't drag anything across the floor. So you have, like, the crawling ability is very hard, you know, and the floor is, like I said, bright white. So if you accidentally bump the ceiling, you have to stop and spend this very long amount of time picking all these little black flakes back off the white formation.
Oh, okay. I was wondering what the significance was that the ceiling was manganese.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It takes a very long time to clean it up.
And so that's like the rule.
Oh, yeah. You'd be very careful. I mean, it's the longest formation in the world, so you don't want to mess up any part of it. But I mean, that crawlway is definitely worth it. But, yeah, so that part's sumped. So if the cave is full of water, you can't get through there. Luckily, the amount of time it takes to fill once it starts filling is a pretty long time. So if it was filling when you were in there, the likelihood that you could exit the cave is very high, you know. So that's not really a worry, but the cave is currently full of water, and it has been for quite a while. We got to go last year, for I think two trips got to go in last year when it was dry.
So what's its status? I mean, like, when are people going back to Fort Stanton Cave, and how long is it so far?
The Fort Stanton Cave Study Project is a really neat project. They do a lot of science in the cave, and they obviously run the exploration program. And they still have expeditions where they have a lot of people come down, and they do science, and they have different projects. They're resurveying parts of the cave, and they have some dig projects they're working on. But obviously the main attraction is Snowy River. And so the cave, you know, it's over 31 miles long, but I don't know the exact length anymore, just because I don't know those resurveys have done since the big passage isn't going right now.
And almost all of the exploration that is still happening is just Snowy River, right? It's just getting to the end of Snowy River and then continuing on, right?
Right, yeah. So, and I mean, and now, you know, Snowy River, after a point, it's split into, there became leads and separate passages, and there's a paleo trunk passage above the main Snow River passage that is much larger than the Snow River passage most of the time. And eventually it turned and went at a different angle from the original passage. So there's surveying there. There have been a couple camp trips that are working on an area at 4:30 a.m. junction. So, I mean, there's more than one lead now too, which is pretty exciting. But all of them in that part of the cave, you have to go past where the water is. So So there's always, they have great hopes of finding a way around that, but we'll see when that comes to fruition.
Let's talk about Lech. What was it like, you know, the first time you got to go in that amazing cave?
I was very lucky, and in a lot of my caving career, you know, I was very fortunate because, like I said, I started here at Jewel Cave, and I got to go caving with immediately, you know, some of the best cavers in the world, like Renee Olms and Dan. You know, my first trip, they were both on it, and so I had great people to teach me. Like you said before, that's really important. And people come here that are great cavers, and I would cave with them. And just like you, I said, you know, I was like, I want to go to Lech Eygiyah, and I really didn't understand why I wanted to go to Lech Eygiyah. I just wanted to go to Lech Eygiyah because it sounded amazing, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure why anybody says that, but has been there like, I want to go. And it's like, well, why? It's like, well, because it's Lech Eygiyah.
Yeah.
You know, so.
It's also a pretty good reason, honestly.
Yeah, right. But so I kept saying I wanted to go, and Derek Bristol was leading a trip with John Lyles, the next edition. And one of the participants, 2 days before the trip, something unfortunate happened with their wife and they had to back out. And so Derek gives me a call and he says, hey, do you want to go to Lech Eygiyah? We're going to go in 2 days. And I said,
this is an 8-day trip.
Yeah. And I was like, yes, I do. And so then I get off the phone and I call my job and said, hey, and I was working at a restaurant then when I was going to school. And I said, hey, I have to leave for 10 days. And if I don't have a job when I get back, that's okay.
They're like, oh, hashtag worth it.
Yeah. I was like, They're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm going caving in New Mexico, and it's this really hard cave to go to. And
I've got my shot.
And I was like, and I'm leaving. And they're like, okay, will you be in today? And I was like, no, I will not be in today.
Oh, no. So that was it then, right? You didn't go back?
No, they actually let me come back. They were cool about it. They understood what I was. They knew that I was like really into the caving thing. But they were the guy in the restaurant was just like, well, all right then. I was like, it's fine. I understand. I was like, but I'm leaving today. So what I did was I, you know, we have a bunch of people here, like I said, that are very experienced. So the gear I didn't already own, they let me borrow, and I packed up all my stuff and drove 16 hours to New Mexico and went in the, like, and like I said, then the next day was that meeting with Stan when I heard about Fort Stanton. And it's a great trip. I mean, the Western borehole in Lech Eygiyah it's amazing.
I can't even imagine. I mean, yeah. I've read Deep Secrets twice, and I've heard people tell me about it, but I just can't, you know, I can't, I won't be able to fully appreciate it unless I ever get to go, which I hope I would, but who knows? Okay. So on the first trip to Lech, did you make any packing mistakes? I've always wanted to ask that, and I've never gotten to. Did you make any mistakes where you're like, you get in there and after maybe a day or two, you're like, oh, I should have brought that.
There's a caver here in the Black Hills. His name is Larry Schaefer. All right. And Larry, he loves Lech Eygiyah, and he's been caving for a long time. And he's very meticulous. And Larry, it just so happens, is also the person who took me on my very first survey trip and my very first time doing vertical. He taught me both the same day.
You got a crash course.
Yeah. We were a two-person team, and he taught me everything I needed to know in that day. But so when I started caving, and I was just talking to Larry yesterday while I was caving with him, that it didn't matter what Larry told me, I would just do it. So my first Jewel trip, whatever he packed, that's what I packed. He likes oatmeal for breakfast. I don't even eat oatmeal. And I took it because I didn't know. I was like, Larry takes oatmeal. I'm taking oatmeal. I didn't even eat it. I just took it in the cave and brought it back out. But so I used Larry's packing list for Lech Eygiyah. And it was actually, of the four trips, the best packing I ever did for Lech Eygiyah. So I just took exactly what Larry would take.
Yeah. What were your shortcomings on the second trip? I mean, you didn't learn anything from the first one?
Well, so the second trip, I thought I could improve upon Larry's list. I ended up with like too much food, and Larry had like this weird sleeping bag that I didn't like. So I brought a different one, but it was too warm. And so I should have just stuck with Larry's stuff. Of course, I had my own gear the second time, not Larry's. I had most of Larry's equipment the first time too. So that helped. But Lech Eygiyah is also, you know, one thing that people should understand about Lech Eygiyah is, and I've had friends say that it's a mature cave survey program. And so one thing you have to understand about Lech Eygiyah is beautiful, and it's one of the most amazing caves in the world. Obviously, it has giant passage. Every formation is jumbo-sized, and there's cave pearls all over the place. You know, I mean, it's just beautiful. But many of the leads have been looked at multiple times. So unless you're very lucky, you're not going to have amazing survey opportunities in there. coming from Jewel Cave, where there's leads, there's lots of leads everywhere, and going to Lech, I was like, oh, this is what we're surveying. You know, we were surveying in this, my first trip, we surveyed a whole bunch of cave in this breakdown maze underneath the keel hull.
Yeah.
And it, yeah. So then my second trip to Lechigia, you know, I got invited in, and I was kind of like, I don't know if I want to go to Lechigia. Those leads were not very good. But then I thought, who doesn't go to Lechigia when they get invited? And I was like, okay. So I went, but I really almost didn't go on my second trip. So that was kind of like the first trip. We spent the first 6 days of it just surveying this stuff that was not very enjoyable. And it was like these crawlways and under breakdown, they call it the boneyard in Lechigia. And it's very sharp and confusing and mazy. And it's kind of like being in the worst parts of Wind Cave. And you're like, oh my gosh. And so on day six, I thought, I'm not coming back to Lechigia again, you know? and part of what was happening on that trip too is that Derek Bristol, and I'm sure you've heard of this, was climbing something called the Kansas City Twister.
Oh, that you were on that trip. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the sixth day there, I was with Dave Lambert and we were surveying in the Kansas City Twister, like two thirds of the way up in this like mid level in a bunch of, it was also in kind of a bunch of breakdown in this weird section of the cave where the giant Kansas City Twister kind of split off to the left. And so we surveyed in there and it was okay. And it was better than the boneyard thing. And so I was sitting in camp and Derek, was still climbing. And when he got back, he was like sleeping next to me and I like sat and everyone, like most of the people were asleep and I like sat up and Derek was like sitting there. And have you met Derek Bristol before?
Yeah. Yeah. I've caved with him once and I interviewed him for the podcast.
Right. Yeah. So he's very, kind of like monotone a lot of the time and not very excitable, but Derek,
yeah.
I looked at Derek and he was just like giddy. And I was like, well, what happened up there? He was like, it goes. It's really big.
But as I understand it, it didn't go far.
So he said it goes really big. And so I said to Derek, I said, can I go with you? And he was like, yeah. And so then the next morning I got to go up there and survey, you know? So
this is like what? 400 feet.
Well, I think the total height, and if Derek has already told you, he wouldn't know better than me, from like the bottom, because there's kind of a big slope at the bottom.
Yeah.
It's like 700 feet tall.
Wow. God.
Yeah. But I don't know how much was actually like a straight climb and how much they could kind of.
But he had a rope hanging in the middle of the room and you climb that up.
There's two relays in it or three relays in it now in that thing to get up there. But anyway, so the next day we get up and we go up there and it's really amazing because you come out of you got this giant climb and there's, like I said, there's some relays in there and a couple places you can get off the rope for a second. But you get up there and you go through this little breakdown crawlway at the top and it pops out and it's 250 feet tall, 950 feet wide.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And in the first room, Munchkinland is 900 feet long, you know? So the first, that day seven of that camp, our team surveyed over 3,000 feet. We surveyed till we ran out of water and paper up there, you know?
God. All then, right. Well, but, never but, color me embarrassed. I had thought that I had heard that it didn't really go that far once you got up there.
There's a fair amount of cave up there. I got to go on the next trip that went up there too. And it was like everyone who could get Derek to let them go. That was like a kind of a famous caver was on that trip though. It was like everybody wanted to go, you know, go up there to Munchkinland. And so that trip in like the first 2 days kind of diminished all the leads that were left, you know? Yeah. So, you know, it went a fair distance, but it only really yielded, you know, a good survey for 4 days for three teams, you know, so, which is still a fair amount of cave. If you think how much cave really good surveys can survey in, you know, 4 days with three teams of them, it's a fair amount of cave.
Yeah. Nothing to sneeze at. Have you ever taken a trip in Lech? And there's so many of these in Lech, but have you ever like gotten up to one of the famous formations or perhaps a new formation and you were just dumbstruck? And if so, where was that? I mean, is there a particular memory in your mind where you just came across a milestone in Lech? Three Amigos, you know, the Chandelier Ballroom, you know, Persian Gulf, whatever. And you were just like, God, this is why I do it.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's a couple of places, you know, And if this is not the right place where these are, I apologize to John Lyles right now, because there's an area called Zanzibar, and I think this is where it is, where it's an entire passageway. It's very large as far as you can see. That's frostwork trees. And it's not one of the famous ones. It's just a place that I thought, you know, there's this little tiny winding trail through them, and it's just all these trees that are ranging from 6 inches tall to 4 feet tall, and it's just a whole forest of them. And we went there on my first trip, and I thought that was, you know, I still think it's one of the most fantastic places you can possibly go. And then I don't know if you've heard of Zion.
Yeah.
So I wasn't on the first team that found Zion, but I was on the team this past year when we went to finish the survey out there. And Zion's pretty amazing. You have to switch into full clean clothes to go into it, because there's so much flowstone. But you end up, you know, you'll be rappelling down a drapery that's, you know, 60 feet wide and 80 feet tall. And I just, and I don't know if you've seen the pictures from that trip, but it's an amazing place. And there's no video of this, but we did like a lead that was halfway up a big climb Derek did the previous year called Space Shot. And the lead went into the ceiling above Zion, and we had to do a bunch of rope like changes to make it happen with the equipment we had. And so Derek did a pull down, but when he came down, he rappelled down a 100-foot tall column that's probably 20 feet in diameter. And we were all of us were sitting there, and we were like, wow, oh my God. And then we were like, we should get a picture of this. And no one got a picture of it.
Of course.
But it's one of those moments, it's almost better that there is no photo, because it's just like everyone that was sitting there was just like, wow.
Yeah, that's yours now. That's yours. I mean, when someone takes a photo, that's fine. We'll wait for it, though. That's yours, and you deserve to have it. That's amazing. What I think about is being there and, you know, you have to have special privileges to go in Lech. And so if you have those special privileges, then you have an idea of how long it takes for something like this to form. And so when you're there, it must feel so ancient, and you must feel so privileged to be in its presence, just because you know enough to appreciate being there. That's just fantastic.
Yeah. 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 I mean, Zion's, it's a very special place. And I'm sad that there's not a lot left as far as leads in there right now. You know, there's some climbs left to do, but there's no obvious way on in there, you know.
Where do you think is among the most promising frontiers in Lech at the moment?
You know, like I said, Lech, it's so hard to say. I mean, I'm not one of the main Lech people. You know, I go kind of, like I said, anytime someone will take me. but I mean, there's no, like, I don't think anybody has something right now that's like, just going, that they're going back to, that they're telling their team, this is the way we're going to go, and this is our main objective. I don't know that anyone has anything like that right now that I've heard. I mean, certainly Zion, there's climbs in there. On the way to Zion, you go through this thing that I'm trying to think of the name of it. It's jellyfish bones. There's this passageway called jellyfish bones that you go through, and it's really, really small and tight. And that was like the breakthrough to find Zion, was they got through this little tight thing and they found Zion. When you go through jellyfish bones, there's an amazing amount of air going through there still, you know? So obviously through there somewhere, there's a way on to something pretty exciting. And Zion, if you look at it, it kind of lines up with the natural continuation of the Western borehole, you know? So that it's one of the most exciting places that I know in the cave, if they can ever find a way.
True. They'll find a way, maybe, I'm sure. Somebody will.
Maybe I'll find a way. Who knows?
Maybe so. I hope you do.
I'll be like, Derek.
It goes. You can get all giddy this time. Well, where else? Where else have you been? What else have you found? Big discoveries.
Well, you know, I mean, like I said, like I spent a lot of time in Jewel, and that's kind of where Mike Wiles was saying in a meeting one time, which is kind of funny. He's like, Jewel Cave is our main squeeze. You know, in Jewel right now, other places that I know, it has the most exciting potential. I mean, I know Renee talked about this when she talked to you, but in 2014, they found the way into that new section. And that new section, every edge of it has pretty exciting leads. You know, on the two trips ago in March, we found a place that Renee and I started surveying there, and we called it the Hidden Forest. What it is, there's two branches of the cave, and between them, there's a square mile of nothing. And the Hidden Forest has a number of walking passage leads going into that big middle section, which is internal, but it's a square mile of land. So, you know, anything could happen in there. And then the end of the cave right now, the lead we're going to, it's 25 feet tall and 50 feet wide at the very end of the cave. So, I mean, those are the best leads that I know of out in Fort Stanton.
Yeah. Have you ever just taken just a nice long recreational weekend, say, down in Tag?
You know, the only caving I've done in any of those caves out there was during the convention this year, and I did a through trip in Rumbling Falls.
Oh, nice. All right. Classic trip.
Yeah. Yeah, which was super cool, and it was funny. You know, it was Sean Lewis and then a number of people from Jewel Cave, you know, because we were all there together. And Dan Austin had been to the Rumble Room before, right?
Yeah.
And we were telling people, you know, we're going to do a through trip. And they were all like, have you been there before? And all of us were like, no. And they're all like, oh, every time we told someone, they were like, oh. And so then it was actually pretty straightforward in the cave. And we did it in about 7 hours the whole way through.
That's not bad.
Yeah, everyone kept being like, oh, 7 hours. So I think that everyone else must like take more time looking at stuff than we did. We probably should have taken more time like taking it in, because we were just kind of running through the cave.
Yeah, you're high performing cavers, so I think that makes sense.
I think all of us could benefit more from like taking it in sometimes, because we were in kind of go mode.
Takes all kinds.
It's an amazing cave, though. It really is.
So that's like the only Tag stuff you've done was from convention this year.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, we got to go down there and try some of the classics. There's a lot I still need to knock off the list down there. You've been to
what's your number one cave?
Mine that I
on
go
list,
to.
What's number one on your list?
Oh, on my list. Oh gosh, I just want to do a bunch of classic stuff down in Tag. You know, I want to do Kegel's Chasm because you can just park and do it. There's a lot of the classics down in Tag that I haven't done. I haven't done Never Sink. I haven't done Stevens Gap, but I have done Flowing Stone down there, and I loved that. I've done Conley Hole, and you know, just anything like that is just a lot of fun. Natural Well, I've done, and so. And I cherish those memories, and I want to go down there and make more, but it'll be a while before I can get back into it. So have you been to Indiana? Have you done any caving in Indiana?
No.
Oh, you got to come out. We got good stuff.
Yeah. You guys have a ton of cavers.
Oh yeah. We got a lot of cavers, and they're all, you know, the very active group down in Binkley. I mean, there's some other stuff going on, but Binkley is our longest cave and they're pushing it longer. And there's a lot of exciting stuff going on down there. And there's a lot of caves sort of adjacent to Binkley that people are working on and trying to connect into Binkley and things like that. And a lot have been successful, and a lot of them just keep growing and haven't quite connected, but it's all the same kind of rock down there. And so it's an exciting frontier down there in Indiana. Just, you know, wet, muddy, fun stuff down there. I mean, it's very different, I would imagine, from Jewel and Letch. You know, it's where it's a little dry and there's not a ton of flowing water there. But we have some fun cave. It's still very active cave for sure.
Yeah, out west, if we find water, we get very excited.
Yeah, exactly. It's very different. Here, it's just a way of life. It's just something you got to endure. A lot of wetsuit, a lot of torn up wetsuits in Indiana.
Oh, imagine. Yeah. Yeah, so for instance, I'm trying to think about a month ago, I guess, we set up the new camping Jewel Cave, right?
Yeah.
And it's called Hell Canyon Camp officially, but it has a couple of other names that people call it because it's so far. But it's, you know, it takes a good team about 10 hours to get there from the entrance one way.
Wow.
And we did it in one shot. So we carried pretty much all the gear in with the 4-person team, set it up, slept in it, and then left the next day. But one thing we had to do on that trip was it took us like an hour and a half to set up this giant drip collector, water collector out there that collects like 15 very slow drips and funnels them all together into a jug.
Okay.
In Indiana, that would never happen.
No, we'd just fill up 6 of them and leave them. How long is it going to take? I don't know, about 3 minutes.
Yeah. We're setting up and we're like, well, we hope this fills up before the next camp.
Yeah, before the next time we come. Yeah. Gosh, that is a different world. I can't even imagine that.
Sure. Each one has its own challenges, you know. We have to carry water everywhere. you guys have to wear wetsuits. You know, there's
yeah.
I mean, it's true. You know, we'll be carrying like three liters of water everywhere, and you guys are, you just get water.
And there are certain caves in Indiana where, I mean, obviously you don't want to play with fire. You don't want to be too dangerous, but there are certain caves in Indiana where if you go in there after a big rain event, it's like being at a water park. It's a lot of fun. You know, I mean, you got to know which caves those are. And you got to be safe about it, but there are some where it's just like, just water shooting out of the wall. You're sliding down flowstone that's otherwise dry. You know, it's great. Is there a trip that you can look back on that was really bad? Like when you were done, you were like, either I'm never going back into that cave, or I could wait a while before I go back into that cave. And if so, what was it and why?
When I first started caving in Jewel Cave, you know, like I was in very good physical shape, and it's kind of that classic thing that we have here. I don't know if it translates to other places where people are new and they're very excited and they want to go to Jewel Cave here. And they're like, I can do it. And we're all like, oh, we don't know, because people go out there. And what happens here is they go a little too far. And then when they're exiting, they just bonk and they can't handle it. And then it's miserable and it takes up forever to get out of the cave and everyone gets cold and nobody has a good time. And so we're very careful here to make sure that doesn't happen, because it can ruin a new caver that's exciting. And we don't want to do that. We want to build cavers, you know? And so when I first started caving, there's this, the big thing in Jewel Cave was this area called the Ant Farm. And the Ant Farm today has over 5 miles of passage in it. It's pretty big, but it takes 5.5 hours or so to get to from the entrance one way. And you have to go through the Miseries, which is the famous crawlway in Jewel Cave, to get there. And the person that was leading it said, like, no, you're too new, you can't go. And so...
Flat out. All right. Well, I appreciate your honesty.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, okay. He's like, I don't think you can do it. And so then like 3 days later, there's a trip going to this place called Coyote Flats. And Coyote Flats, there was nothing out there then, but now it's past where the first camp is out west in the western branch. They're in different branches. And the person on that trip was like, sure, you can come. And so I went with him, and everyone on the trip was really good. And they'd been caving in Jewel Cave for a long time. And I was brand new, and they didn't give me, or I didn't ask, I guess, because I was trying to feel like I knew what I was doing. I didn't get any good information about what was going on. So I carried all this extra water that I didn't need out there, because there was water collectors I didn't know about. And we were going really fast because everyone also knew the route. And I was keeping up because I wanted to show that I could do it, you know. And by the time we got out from that trip, I remember like going to the visitor center and just being like, I don't know if I ever want to go in a cave again. I was just... Like I was carrying like extra water and going faster than I've ever gone. I didn't know anything about the cave we were going through. I'd never been out there through any of it before, like 0% of it. And we were in like I said, it was about 5 hours out, 5 hours back, and plus survey. And I was just,
you're just gassed.
Yeah. But what made it all worthwhile is when the guy leading the Ant Farm trip was on that trip, and he said, okay, I guess you can go to the Ant Farm. And so I was like, woo!
Nice. You earned your spot.
Yes, I got to go to the Ant Farm.
You paid your dues.
Yeah. The Ant Farm is also where I learned, you know, because I'd been on a bunch of survey trips before that, but I was very new, and we were surveying stuff that wasn't, you know, prime. You know, we were surveying in Main Cave and in Wind Cave, which has good stuff in Wind Cave, nothing against Wind Cave. But nothing was going big passage. In the Ant Farm, we went out there, and I was on point, and it was the first time that we ever like started surveying something, and it was just this giant going passage as far as I could see, you know. And that's
fantastic.
And I went running down it, and Renee Holmes was like, "Whoa, we don't do that!" And I was like, "But it's so big." She's like, "Yeah, we don't do that."
You were scooping? Is that what it was?
Yeah, it was my first chance to really scoop in something that wasn't the crawlway.
Hey, we don't do that here.
Yeah, I didn't know any better.
Is there a particular piece of gear that you just love that you have, or perhaps something that you really want?
Well, I mean, I guess I don't know. So here in South Dakota, we use side packs. So I don't know if are you familiar with the side pack?
I mean, is that just a style, or is that a particular kind? I mean,
so they used to be made by Lost Creek, and you know, Lost Creek is kind of non-existent anymore these days. The bag sits on, like, it goes over your shoulder,
yeah,
and around your waist, and then it sits on your side.
I've seen them, yeah.
Yeah, so those are pretty important to Jewel Cave caving. You don't have to. I mean, I don't. The park wants you to use them, but I don't. I think you could do it without one, but your efficiency would be less. So they're pretty important. Other than that, I think that we use pretty standard gear here. You know, one thing that we do here is we wear tights and shorts in the cave.
Yeah, you kind of have to, don't you?
Yeah. So it's tights and shorts, even in the cave's 49 degrees, and that really confuses a lot of people that come to visit, and they think they need a cave suit or the 49 degrees is going to be too cold. But once you start going, you know, it's very vigorous in the cave here. So you're sweating your butt off in there.
What kind of light do you have?
Well, so I have a few lights. I have Aspelio Noma, which became my daughter's light for a while, and then
that's a pretty good light for a 6-year-old.
yeah, and then we started. Our Garda started this program called that we were calling like the mentorship program, where we found someone that we thought was gonna be really great at caving that was excited, and each one of the experienced people would kind of take them under their wing and say like, okay, we're gonna help this person get as far as they can go as fast as they can. And so the person that was my person, he's using that light right now because his broke. So,
oh yeah, well good.
But so Brooklyn doesn't have that light right now. But so I have that, and I have a Sten. I'll probably, as long as it works, always have a Sten light because I think they're just so reliable and they're such a good light. They're not the brightest anymore. They're not the most efficient, but they're so reliable and so good. And we have Disto X's, so the magnetic thing isn't much of an issue these days.
It was it that first Sten that you bought back in the early days?
No, actually, you know, my first Sten was the second generation, so I have a third generation Sten now. I don't know if it's the premium or the plus that was the third one, but that's the one I have now. So I have the newest Sten version that there is. Then I also have a Scurion 1500.
Oh, boy. So, okay.
Yeah. So the reason I got mine was that I was in Lechuguilla on this blast trip, and Hazel, Barton, and Derek were both in there, and they both had one. In big passages like that, it's a pretty amazing light.
I can imagine.
If you're serving in small passage, it's not actually that good because it's almost too much. But if you want to serve a borehole, that's the light.
Yeah, it's a lech light because there's a lot of those big areas. It's just like that.
Falls perfect for rumbling. I'll take it to Rumbling Falls. It was perfect in there. You could see the whole room when you were coming down still.
Oh my god.
The room, you know, so.
I mean, for some people that'd be okay, but I think for others it'd be like, maybe not as bright a light. Maybe I don't want the full perspective of where I am right now precariously up on this giant. Yeah. Yeah. But I can understand it. I can understand. I would certainly turn it up for a little bit and then maybe turn it back down and focus on what I'm doing.
but I mean, like I don't use it every day. Like I went caving 5 days in the last 8 days.
Wow.
And I only wore the Scurry on one of those days. So.
Yeah. Well, when you have as many choices, yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah. I guess I do want to add one thing. So before, you're asking me about like what's important, you know, and I was saying like access, and we kind of got off on a different tangent, but I mean like, you know, the organization, we need to make it so people can have that, you know, like I was saying, that moment that makes them love caving, right? That's why I think we're here. That's what our grotto's mission is, you know, now. That's why we're being successful, because we're trying to help people do something, right? But so you have to have access to caves, but you also have to have the, like, people, like you said, that want to teach other people how to go caving. You have to have the conservation background so that you can continue going to these places and leaving them in a state that's still amazing for the next group of people to come in, right?
Right.
I mean, those are all super important things. And like I was saying, so one of the things that we did, that mentorship thing, it's been extremely successful, even though we only have 1.5 people that have completed it. But the person that I was saying his name is Nick, that has my daughter's light right now, he, in 2019, I think he will have surveyed more than anyone else in 2019 in Jewel Cave. Like he's currently number one on the list on the books. I mean, like, you can do anything if you have motivated people and they want to help.
And I think that's a good message to put out there. Also, along the same lines, if you yourself want to be involved, just find the people who are doing stuff. Most of the time, if you're willing to go the distance with them and you're not too annoying, you're going to be invited back time and time again.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all it takes.
Yeah, don't complain. That's like number one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Be fun to be around, and if you feel like you're not fun to be around, just keep quiet. If you want to keep going, just do it, and as long as you're useful, people are going to keep inviting you back.
And the other thing here's another thing I was thinking about today before this podcast about like caving, and I was thinking about like how caving is such an interesting group of people, and everybody's very diverse. And you know, you start, and I'm sure this happened to you too, that you start caving and you show up and you kind of have no idea what's going on and who knows what about which caves and anything, right? And you spend a huge amount of your first part of your caving time trying to get on cave trips, right? I don't know if that's how it was for you, but
I've heard of people having that. I mean, I'm just a recreational caver, but there is that sort of struggle at the beginning. You're just like, okay, who's going? Hello.
Yeah, right. So then you spend all this time and you're like, oh, I just want to go caving. And then eventually you make enough connections that you can go caving kind of as much as you want to. And I think like there's like once you get to like a certain point, it's like you almost don't realize what's happening. But then you're like, oh, I'm a trip leader. I can go caving.
Yeah, you do kind of come to that threshold at some point, right?
Yeah, you're like, I can lead expeditions in Jewel Cave for 4 days if I want to.
it's an exciting time. Yeah, I remember leading my first trip and it going well. And I was like, all right, cool. Now I can do this.
And so I guess my point with that is just remember, once you can lead trips, that other people are still in that first stage where they just want to go on trips.
You can be that person who can go, and then you also get to go.
Right, yeah. And you'll have to, once you get your children in place and set up, come caving in the dry west.
You know what? Southwestern South Dakota is, I can't wait. I really can't wait.
Well, I mean, 2022, you definitely have to come because we're going to have a convention.
I know. That'll be my excuse. Well, Adam, thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. This has been fun.
It was great talking to you.
I'm rolling, so I guess we'll get started. The last time I talked to you was late July, and since then you've been a little busy.
Yeah, so I mean, I was trying to add it up on the way back from Fort Stanton, and this year, since you know, in all of 2019, I think I've mapped something like 74,000 feet of cave.
74,000. All right, doing some quick math in American miles, as it were. Gosh, what is that? Okay, 74,000. That's 14 miles of cave. Good grief!
Yeah, it's been a great year.
That's amazing. So Fort Stanton, it's now November 19th. This episode comes out December 1st. Fort Stanton just saw a really big, was it one weekend of exploration added like miles to the map?
No. So, I mean, so Fort Stanton, you probably already know, you know, it floods a lot of years and they have a really big bat population. So there's a short window you can get in there. And this year that window was about 3 weeks long. So there were three weekend trips that got to go in to do like the big surveys. There were other trips that went in and did science and photography and recon. And so there were a number of trips, but there were three big mapping trips that went in. And the first one I was on, we got 2.34 miles. The second one, they went to the end of our survey and they pushed really hard towards the historic section of the cave. And they got 4,700 feet, which compared to 2.34 miles sounds like not very much, but anywhere else, it's like amazing, right? You know, so.
Well, yeah. I mean, okay. So if they picked up where you left off, how long did it take to get you where you left off, I guess? You know, because it takes a while. Is Fort Stanton a linear cave? I mean, I know the Snowy River is a long, you know, calcite formation, but does Fort Stanton finger out?
Yeah, so it does have some branching at the upstream end. But so Fort Stanton, basically where the Snowy River Passage is, you have a lower level, like what they call the longest passage in the world, you know, it's Snowy River, really long. And then above that, there's a passageway, the Paleo Passage, and it's often larger than the Snowy River Passage, and it's just higher. So what our team did, and this has been a long-term project Garrett Jorgensen's been working on, is mapping that upper level, really big passage. And so, you know, we went through the historic section, which is about a mile of cave. and then about a third of the way south down Snowy River itself, and then up into that upper level passage. And so it's pretty big, nice cave. We got we found this passage that we called the perfect passage because it was 15 by 15 and with a soft dirt smooth floor with no rocks in it.
No wonder you bagged so much.
And it was like that for 3,000 feet straight. We're taking 220-foot shots.
So almost 2.4 miles in what? You said like a 36-hour trip?
Yeah, we're in the cave for 36 hours. Yeah.
Good grief.
We did the first 10,100 feet before we slept. So you did a short little like 4-hour nap in there. And so we did 10,100 feet. And when we got up after the nap, though, we were kind of like, I don't know. We want to map more? Is it needed?
But you did.
We did. Yeah, we have some more. But
you lunatics.
Yeah, so.
Good for you, though. So that's exciting. So it's this short window when anyone can get in there for exploration, and that's the same every single year. Does it flood at the same time every year? Or
every year it's a little bit different. There was a big flood. I think people talked about this to you before, a few years ago, where it flooded for 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
And never unflooded. And one of the big hopes for this upper level passage is now we're not too far away from the historic section of the cave. I'm not sure the distance apart because the map isn't done, but it isn't a huge distance away from the historic section. So, there might be a chance someday somebody will dig through and the water problem won't be a problem as much anymore.
And to familiarize people with Fort Stanton Cave, people who might not have heard of it or know much about it, it's a cave, it's on BLM property, right?
Right.
Bureau of Land Management, but it also runs under some private property, and there's an understanding that no exploration will be done under that private property. So you're doing the legit sanctioned exploration, and you're adding this much to the map. But the potential for this cave is even greater than we're able to even look at, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was on the team in 2012, I think. That map to the end of the Snowy River Passage, right to kind of where they've requested we don't map past. And in the lead there, it's something, and I'm one of those people too, that as you look back, leads, they change a little bit from reality and you start to make them better than they are. But I looked at a picture of it last week as I was doing a presentation, and it's like 20 by 80 or something at the end.
Just this void, just this maw that's just calling you, and legalities dictate that you can't go any further. That's got to be frustrating.
And and they've been working on that, and I think at some point they'll get that worked out. I think it's kind of a weird situation because I think it's a like not just one property, it's a number of properties, so they have to get it worked out with multiple people.
Yeah, it's a delicate situation, and it's not something that can be it's something you've got to kind of approach lightly. I completely understand. Anything more on Fort Stanton you want to share?
Well, I gotta at least say this. So the third trip that went in there, they got over 11,000 feet on their trip.
Wow.
So we had 2.34 miles, 4,700 and something, and then over 11,000 on the third trip. So it took the cave to just over 40 miles long.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What else have you been up to?
Yeah, so, and we've talked very little about it, but, I'm really a Jewel Cave caver. That's my hometown cave is Jewel Cave. And this past year, we did a little bit over 8 miles in Jewel Cave. We put in a new camp, so that's pretty exciting. The new camp, I think it's about 12 hours from the entrance one way. So that's pretty exciting stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just to get to the new camp. That's pretty exciting. And there's still lots and lots of potential in there for more stuff, right?
Absolutely. And then, the cave right now, they're redoing the whole tour route inside of the cave. And so while that construction is going on, we can't go map because we'd have to go through the construction and that's not really good for anybody.
Yeah.
But so our very last day trip before the construction started, we went not to where the new camp is, but the east side of the cave, where there hasn't been a lot of exploration in the last 10 years because the new stuff, we've put 30 miles since 2014 in the new area out west. And so off the east edge of the cave, you have to go through this terrible crawlway that we named It's a Trap. because it's 8 inches tall, and then there's like a body length of 10 inches tall, then it's a, then there's a 7.5 inch tall squeeze, then a body length that's a foot tall, then 8 inch squeeze again. So if you get, if you can't fit through the middle squeeze, you're kind of stuck backing out through an 8 inch squeeze.
Oh my God, how long is this thing?
It's like I said, it's only like two body lengths long, but there's like three little tight spots in a row.
8 inches and then 7 inches? Oh my God, yeah. How does anyone make it?
That's how Kuehl Cave kind of works. It always makes you, if there's going to be something good, it makes you put in the extra effort. I wasn't on the team that found it, but I got to be on the second team there. And like I said, the day before the exploration was kind of done for this year, we went out there and we got a half a mile of pretty big passage on a day trip. So that's a whole, it's like a whole new frontier going east.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's, it's pretty exciting. The lead that I left at the end of the day, the Elruds were 10, 20, 98, 6.
What does that mean?
Elruds?
Yeah. I'm not an exploration caver.
Yeah, so it's the left, right, up, down.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So at every station, we record the left, right, up, down from the station. So, you know, it's 10 feet to the left, 20 feet to the right, 98 feet up, and 6 feet down from where the station was at.
Gotcha.
So we're talking a super tall passage.
And that's where you left off.
That's where we left off, yeah. So
there's plenty for the rest of them.
Right. Absolutely, yeah.
What else you been doing since July 25th?
Well, then also, I mean, I would be remiss, I guess, if I didn't talk about Wind Cave. Wind Cave is here.
Of course.
And Wind Cave's great. Wind Cave just had the 150th mile celebration. And there's recently been some pretty cool stuff going on in Wind Cave, too. Hazel Barton came back to a lead that she left in the 90s. And that lead has gone into some pretty big walking passage. Now, in the last trip, we got 1,500 feet, which in Wind Cave is a super, super good trip. And most of the passage was pretty big. And so everyone's really excited about that because it's, you know, for the first time in quite a number of years, there's going passage off the edge of the map in Wind Cave. And the footprint's going to change. I mean, it's already changed quite a bit from the last two trips in there. And so it's going to no longer be a little bubble, a cave. It's going to be expanding. So, and the other things I've been doing, I mean, you know, the NSS, we, you know, I try to do as much work as I can to help out with that. And we talked last time about the IO, the Internal Organization Newsletter. And like I told you, the goal is to get information out to the leaders of grottos and other organizations inside of the NSS so they know what's going on and they feel more aware of the bigger group.
And so that's all going okay then?
It seems to be going pretty well.
Man, I'm so impressed at what's going on in Jewel and Wind, and Fort Stanton is a saga that I can't get enough of. And I am just, I got to tell you, I'm living vicariously through people like you and all of the Facebookers who are posting stuff. You know, I see Hazel's posts and the NSS posts and things like that on their page. And it's just so exciting what's going on. And it just goes to show there's still plenty more to find.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's cave everywhere. We surveyed this past weekend in this little cave locally called Mystic Cave. And Mystic was previously surveyed at 2,600 feet. And we thought we'd go in and do it and just run through a resurvey of the cave and update the map. And that thing will not end. It's very crawly and it's very hard to survey and it will not end. It's going to end up being over a mile long cave for sure.
you went in and pretty much doubled it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We all thought we'll take three teams in, we'll do it in a day. And we left with tons of leads and we don't even know what to do with it. Cause they're all super crawly.
And yeah. And again, I'm not an exploration caver, but I've been in my fair share of low tight crawls that are miserable. I can only imagine what it's like to go in a cave where we know there's 2,600 feet and the people who originally surveyed it just didn't want to do those nasty crawls. And you're going in there and you're doing the real work and you're doubling the length of the cave.
Yeah. Yeah. And we thought, you know, in our grotto, this is going to be a great opportunity to get new people into a cave that's not real long and they can survey and they'll learn. And we're going to, it'll be a great building event for the grotto. And we got all these people and, you know, I don't know if my first survey trip, if I went and surveyed in a passageway that was 12 inches tall for 8 hours if I would have wanted to go again. But, but we've got some dedicated new people, and I think it's great.
Well, it's situations like that when you just when you learn what you're made of, you know.
Right.
Well, Adam, I am so excited for all the stuff you're finding, and I know this is your episode, but I would love more updates if you feel like sharing them.
Yeah, hopefully 2020 will also be a great year.
Well, keep after it, man. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks, Ben.
How was that, huh? Pretty wild. I want to go caving with that guy. Adam Weaver, thanks for getting after it, man. And thank you for listening. And for the first time in months, I do not know who next month's guest will be. I've been pretty diligent in banking up interviews this year in preparation for the birth of our second child, who came in August. But now that he's here, I'm going to have to start reaching out and getting some more interviews recorded. So hopefully I can ring in 2020 with a great caving interview. We'll see you then. Hey, support the podcast by supporting caving. Go to give to your grotto, give to the NSS, give to your local karst conservancy, or this month's featured conservancy, the West Virginia Cave Conservancy. Again, you can find them at wvcc.net, and I'll put that link in the description. Also, thanks to Swago, our first sponsor. Always glad to give them a plug. If you do wet caving, you want a Swago pack. Get one at swagogear.com. Also, Organic Robot on Etsy, digital art for analog living. Great caving and outdoor-themed t-shirts. Check them out. All one word, Organic Robot on Etsy. Is that it? I think so. Thanks again. I'm Matt Pelser from the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.